Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to do a phone interview with one of my favorite interviewees, a frequent guest on my weekday program of Health Talk. She is none other than the Hoffman Center nutritionist, a person that I work with on a daily basis to help patients. She's known to you, many of you, Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian. She also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And it's a pleasure to inaugurate this series of interviews here on Health Talk with, easy to forget, Intelligent Medicine. I'm so used to saying Health Talk because of my weekend program. Welcome, Layla. It's nice having you aboard.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. This is so exciting. Thank you so much.
Yes. Okay. So to just describe a little bit the technology that we're using, it's a little bit of a workaround. I'm speaking to you. You're in the office covering patients. I'm at my home studio using Skype to connect with you, and we're using a simple program to record this program. So let's take it away. First of all, for some of our listeners who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about who you are, how you got into the field of nutrition, and what you do at the Hoffman Center.
Oh, wow. How much time do we have? Oh, I'm kidding.
We could do a series of five broadcasts on this.
Oh, well, I'll let me just start by saying that nutrition is my second career. And really, it was just prompted by a calling. After a lot of other work in corporate America, I was always interested in nutrition, even as a teenager. And you know, as a teenager, you don't necessarily have the maturity to follow through on anything. But this has always been a love of mine. And finally, I went back to school and everything. I got my degrees. I became a nutritionist. So
by the time you went back to school, you weren't just a kid, you know, fresh out of high school or
exactly,
a 2-year associate's degree. You actually had graduated from college. You went into a profession. You knocked around for a while, which is actually similar to my background. I spent a couple of years working for the city of New York, and I decided I really wanted to study medicine. So by the time you went back to school, you went back with a real focus and determination, and you were a young adult who was, you know, very committed to the field of nutrition.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, the stars lined up, and I landed with Dr. Atkins while he was alive, and that was an amazing learning experience. And then after his
what a plum job, you know, right out of nutrition school, you got a job at Dr. Atkins' office, and I guess you saw some real miracles there.
Well, I really, really did. And I'll tell you, every day that I was there and with all the mentoring and everything, I would come home and pretty much devour my pathophysiology textbook every night, just wanting more. And then as I became an RD, and then I was in, after his death, of course, the practice closed. And then I said, well, what will I do now? And I was, I became a hospital dietitian, which was interesting. And, you know, it is a core fundamental knowledge for RD, so it's a very important experience. Of course, I already had that experience. And then I was working at a major hospital in New York, and then I saw posting.
But what were some of, you know, prior to you know, getting to starting to work with me at the Hoffman Center, what was your hospital experience like? Were there some frustrations because you had to sort of play it by the book in conventional nutrition, or did you see people who you saw, if only I could really fully manage them with a very, very affirmative nutritional program, they could get well, but unfortunately, in the hospital setting, your ability was limited.
Exactly, and that was the most frustrating part. Now, you know, seeing patients, assessing their caloric needs, which is somewhat outdated today, but you know, the only tool we had besides for various formulations for tube feeding or total parenteral nutrition, which is different, you know, there was Ensure. Which is unfortunate.
Which is what they gave me when I landed in the hospital with a broken hip.
In fact, they
kept bringing in more and more Ensure.
Right.
That was their idea of how they were going to get me properly nourished. Until I couldn't see my TV set from my bed. There was a pyramid of Ensure cans on my tray. And of course, you know, all the while I had gotten friends and relatives to bring me really delicious, nutritious non-hospital food to eat so that I could actually get well. And finally, I'll share with you this story. The nutritionist came in and said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And I said, "I am a professional medical nutritionist, and what I would like you to do, since I'm pretty much covered in terms of the field of nutrition from my own knowledge base, is could you please remove all these cans of Ensure from my table so that I can see my TV and relax?" And she looked a little cowed and intimidated, and, you know, pretty soon the Ensure was gone, and I was able to, she never came back to the room.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's hospital dietetics. That's right. What it is. So, you know, our abilities there are limited. There's only so much we could do. We're supposed to follow a particular formulary. And I'll tell you, Dr. Hoffman, I've written progress notes where, say, for instance, a patient with hepatitis or compromised liver status, where I'd say alpha-lipoic acid, I would say milk thistle. And, you know, nobody's going to pay attention to any of this, and it's not part of the hospital formulary, and doctors scratching their heads but not even calling me about it or anything like that. So, and then the stars lined up again, and I found your job posting at the Hoffman Center in 2005.
And the rest is history.
And
we're working on 10 years of collaboration together. So, you know, the drill is usually, you know, people see me obviously for various types of medical problems or simply to optimize, and, you know, I try to analyze their medical issues. And then, you know, I tell them what to do, and then they say, "But, you know, what do I eat?" And I say, "You know, I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. I think you really should talk to Layla about that." And you're perfectly willing to provide them with detailed information on, yes, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and specific implementation of our nutritional plan. Yes. So that's how the collaboration works. So anyways, and also you've also spearheaded a series of great seminars at the Hoffman Center. They are held usually on a monthly basis, although we're taking a hiatus this summer. And what are some of the topics that we've covered in those great seminars?
Oh, we've covered vitamin D. We've covered diabetes and metabolic syndrome. We've covered
prediabetes.
Yes, osteoporosis. We've covered the paleo diet. We've covered GI problems, GI conditions such as Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, GERD, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, all of those.
Yep.
Food and mood, all kind. Food and mood I've done quite often because the demand was so great, and we'd always have a nice turnout. Let's see. I'm trying to think.
And most recently, this is the skin condition one, where, you know, actually,
yes.
And you might say, well, what does it have to do with nutrition? I mean, basically, are we talking about skin cream here? And yes, to some extent, but 99% of the skin problems relate to internal stuff. And it's not what you lube onto your skin. It's, you know, getting an internal lube job or getting antioxidants internally that helps to preserve your skin quality. So that was a great seminar recently.
Absolutely. Our skin is really a mirror of our internal environment. And that's all about the GI tract, the bowel, and cleaning that up and reinoculating it with healthy bacteria. We have to take care of our microbiome.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
So, to switch subjects to something perhaps a little less pleasant, lately, and, you know, I share with you the articles that I talk about on Health Talk, and we do a lot of collaboration, emailing back and forth different articles that we find. And lately, there's been a spate of publicity in the wake of a very, very snarky editorial in the New York Times by a doctor named Paul Offit. He's the developer of the rotavirus and a self-appointed expert on all things integrative and alternative, mainly because he's been very, very vociferously attacked by vaccine skeptics, people who are concerned about the ill effects of vaccines. He developed a vaccine. Of course, he's got a dog in the fight. He's a proponent of vaccines. And after his encounter with the vaccine skeptics, he took on the entire alternative medicine establishment and wrote books skeptical about alternative medicine, and most recently wrote an editorial on vitamins and supplements that was dramatically titled, "Don't Take Your Vitamins."
Yeah.
What was your take on that?
Well, first of all, after my initial anger and outrage, because it appears even since the beginning of my career with Dr. Atkins, we are constantly defending the field of integrative, complementary, alternative medicine and nutrition. Call it what you want, all three titles. So here we go again. And now we know, because the pharmaceutical industry, the vaccine industry, has a vested interest in not letting supplements come to the forefront because they can't be patented, no profits can be made. So here we are. You and I know, and we are chronically or constantly beaten over the head with these all the time. And it's a good thing now that we have our newsletter and you have these podcasts so that we can respond appropriately to these outrageous. I mean, why is this stuff even published? It's amazing. Well, you have to get your own op-ed on NewYorkTimes.com. You have to do something. You have to have a full-page article against.
Right, that'll be the day. Because, I mean, you know, my theory is, and I've enunciated it quite a lot, is that I think there really is sort of a triumvirate between the complicit press, which swallows these stories hook, line, and sinker very readily, particularly the press that leans towards more government regulation. I think that there's a tendency for some of the mainstream press to, you know, journalists, look, they're idealistic individuals, they're reformers for the most part, and they want to safeguard and protect the public. And that's, you know, they're always
yellow too.
Right. And there's yellow journalism too, that, you know, where you talk about scandals and cover-ups. But I think what you got is you got the journalists on the one hand. You've got obviously the people in the pharmaceutical industry who tend to look down their noses at vitamins and supplements, although many of the vitamin companies lately have been targets of takeover by large pharmaceutical companies. I think they see that they need to diversify their portfolio because there's a certain percentage of the population that just they're not going to make a lot of money off them taking medications, so they want to sell them supplements. And then there's, of course, the medical establishment, certain people in the medical establishment, I won't paint it with a broad brush, who really have been schooled to disdain natural therapies. They think it's, you know, unscientific claptrap, it's quackery, and, you know, that's part of our training and orientation as doctors, to look down our noses at natural therapies. Or, you know, what we don't know about, we tend to disregard, or hold in contempt.
So aren't many medical schools also funded by pharma?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, I mean, through various types of grants, the medical conferences are often underwritten by the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, clearly there is a built-in bias. But so, you know, when you saw that article, I mean, basically what he's saying is that studies now show that supplements are dangerous or harmful. And he actually cited several studies that showed that vitamins A were not beneficial for certain conditions and that B, they could even be harmful. So he's saying, why does this dumb public persist in believing in vitamin supplements? What's your take on that?
Well, Dr. Hoffman, I think the biggest crime of all is many of these studies are not valid. They're not repeatable. The methodology is flawed. They shouldn't even be brought to light because they're fairly worthless. There are a lot of problems with it, and other articles, as well as your own articles, have pretty much shown light on all of that. A lot of this research he's talking about to the sheeple, pretty much. And whoever's reading it and taking his word for it, I really, really feel sorry for, because it's not true. How much have we read, how many headlines over the past few years have we seen in the media that were blatantly incorrect because we've gone to the research ourselves and looked at it and said, but that's not the conclusion they drew. Where did this come from? How in the world can you come to this conclusion based on this methodology or this analysis or this N number, you know, the number of participants, right, or subjects in the particular study? So there's all of this that people just don't know about, and, you know, there are just headlines and headlines.
Yeah,
anybody can say anything they want.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of, and I often emphasize this on Health Talk and now in the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, it's a matter of scientific literacy, is that we have journalists who sometimes parrot the conclusions of studies. But actually, if you bother to take the time, and you know, it's arduous, it's difficult. You got to actually pull out these articles. They're tough to find. You have to find them. You have to go through, you know, 15 pages of dry text. And then when you pick the article apart, suddenly you realize that this article is not necessarily an indictment of vitamins or supplements. They may be making a narrow point about the chemical properties of this, that, or the other. Synthetic vitamins, such as alpha tocopherol or beta carotene, supplements which are relatively outmoded now because we don't use them anymore at the Hoffman Center. We use mixed carotenoids and we used mixed tocopherols, more broad spectrum, more like nature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then we draw overarching conclusions that all vitamins and supplements are somehow bad. And then, of course, and you've heard this from your patients, there are so many patients who say, but my doctor says that there aren't any studies. True or false? There aren't any studies about vitamins and supplements?
Unbelievable at that one. That one and the other comment from patients is, but my gastroenterologist says diet has nothing to do with my inflammatory bowel disease. Both of those make me want to pull my hair out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's just, this is what we're having to deal with.
Well, yeah, there's a great deal of skepticism. So let's not dwell on the negative because, you know, clearly, you know, we realize that there is a bias. There are people who harbor outmoded attitudes towards alternative medicine, integrative practices.
But, and, you know, it's only from ignorance.
And it's changing.
And I really Yes.
I mean, I got to think back, you know, 30 years ago. What I did was really considered an outlaw type of medicine. We were really considered renegades. And now there are entire medical school and university programs that are devoted to the training of complementary physicians. So, you know, I think that there's progress that's been made. So let's not dwell on the negative. Speaking of an inflammatory bowel disease, that's an important part of, you know, what we treat. We treat a lot of gastrointestinal problems. Let's start with GERD, for example. It's, you know, one of the most common conditions in America, and probably, you know, the number one or two or three drug that's sold in America is some sort of powerful acid blocker, or the whole category of drugs like Nexium and Protonix. Prilosec. These medications are so commonly prescribed for any type of gastrointestinal problem. What's our approach to that type of problem? Say somebody comes in with heartburn, GERD, you know, they're told they have excess acidity, but the medications only sort of work. They don't really answer
We have a therapeutic GERD diet, which includes the elimination of gluten, which includes the elimination of many of the spicy foods, which are pretty much well known. If anything spicy, Bernie, of course, eliminate it, but other things like acidic foods, coffee and tea. People mistakenly think it's the caffeine that's causing their... It's not the caffeine. It's the acid. It's the acid. Things like tomato juice, carminatives like the mint, chocolate, all of those certain fruits, certain
vegetables.
So
somebody chewing on lifesavers to moisten their throat, they may actually... Or chewing spearmint gum, they may actually be worsening their GERD.
Yes, yes, exactly. Some of the ways we treat it, DGL is a wonderful one. Very soothing, very emollient, but it's also very important that we're able to taper them off, the Prilosec, the Nexium, the Protonix, and all of that, without heavy rebound effect. DGL is very helpful with that, and so is Endofen powder. Endofen is actually wonderful.
Spell it
for
us.
E-N-D-E-F-E-N.
Okay.
Endofen.
And that consists of a variety of things. I noticed that there's some plantago in there, which is a mucilaginous substance from plantains, right?
Yes. There's some EGCG in there. There's arabinogalactans.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of these. And it's very, very helpful over time to reduce the incidence of GERD. Primarily, they do need to be following the eating plan. You don't take these and then go eat, you know, spicy chicken wings for dinner, you know.
Right.
You might as well stay on the Prilosec then if that's what you're going to do.
Another thing, I'm sure you, and you derived this from your experience with Atkins early on, is that surprisingly the same diet that helps people lose weight and that helps people avoid metabolic syndrome, you know, high triglycerides and prediabetes, is diet low in carbohydrates. That's, you know, Atkins was a proponent of that. And for many patients with certain types of GERD and other types of irritable bowel, they benefit from a lower carb diet. Why would that be?
It's the removal of gluten. Primarily, it's the removal of gluten. Gluten is such an offender for acid reflux. So generally that, and I'll tell you, I have heard from so many patients over the years who were on the Atkins diet and then one day they cheat and they have a half a slice of bread, and the GERD symptoms come roaring back.
Wow.
Amazing how that happens.
Right.
Yeah.
And perhaps even, you know, lowering the carbohydrates, because there is a fermentive component to gastrointestinal problems. So if you've got a fermenting vat in your stomach due to, say, your breakfast is, you know, shredded wheat with skim milk and a glass of orange juice, you're going to create a fermenting vat in your stomach, and a lot of gas production will occur, and you'll reflux your food contents upwards.
Absolutely. The most fermentable food groups are, in this order, the grains and then fruit.
Right.
So that standard American breakfast is not the breakfast of champions.
For sure not. For sure not for a lot of our patients. So let's move down. We're going to move gradually down the GI tract. Let's move down a little further to the intestine. And a big problem for a lot of people is IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And we see a lot of people with IBS. We have a lot of experience with that. One of the new paradigms that's helping us relieve symptoms for a lot of patients is something called the FODMAPS diet.
Yes.
Can you describe that? Because it's been very, very helpful for many of our patients with IBS.
Yeah. The FODMAPS is actually the acronym for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. That's a real mouthful.
Wow.
Isn't it? So the FODMAPS and some of the main of these fermentable carbohydrates to actually eliminate, wheat is actually one of them.
That's actually the F in the FODMAPS. It's a fructan.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and milk products are often problematic for people with IBS. There are certain fruits and vegetables that are also problematic. Things such as onions or eggplant, cabbage, broccoli, all of these. But over time, IBS, there are a lot of variables with IBS. It's also very important to look at the ecology of the gut, to see if there's any bad bacteria growing that we need to get rid of with something like, say, olive leaf or biocidin,
mm-hmm.
which is very, very helpful.
Yeah, biocidin, we're listening on it. It's a tincture, but it's very purple. And the main herb in it is gentian, which actually gives the name to gentian violet. It's a very violet color. And it's a potent suppressor of yeast, as well as harmful bacteria. So we have our patients take that off. And actually, gentian used to be used to treat vaginitis. You'd actually paint the vaginal area with gentian. I remember the first time I was a doctor in training and examined a woman who'd had gentian violet painted down there. And,
wow.
Purple. It was all purple. And then I realized it was the medication. Anyway, that's just a little medical aside. All right, so gentian can be something that can be used to suppress the harmful bacterial or fungal growth in the intestinal tract. And then, of course, you mentioned probiotics. Probiotics are important.
Probiotics are very important because once we get rid of the harmful bacteria, and biocidin is so effective at that. I just keep seeing that over and over. And it's very gratifying to see. Then, of course, we have to re-inoculate the gut with beneficial bacteria, probiotics,
As an aside, you know, you've actually opened up the practice a little bit to the use of fermented foods and live foods. That's, I think, an important consideration because a lot of people think of, well, I'll take a probiotic pill or I'll have some active yogurt. But there are other ways to put beneficial bacteria back in your intestinal tract. Share that with us.
Absolutely. There are certain foods that are probiotic foods, such as sauerkraut. But, you know, not that package of sauerkraut next to the hot dogs in your grocery store. We're talking about a product that is simply cabbage and salt or fermented cabbage. Typically, this would come in a jar. It may, you know, it's a good high quality, maybe from Europe, maybe Hungarian or even German. But you could even make it at home if you wanted to do that. What happens when the cabbage is fermented is the beneficial bacteria forms. And did you know that cabbage, the vitamin C in cabbage is actually multiplied tenfold. The vitamin C content is tenfold in the sauerkraut rather than in raw cabbage. So there's things like sauerkraut. There's other foods like kimchi. As well, I'm a huge fan of kimchi. There's always a jar of kimchi, which is like, it's Chinese cabbage. It's fermented bok choy with some spicy red pepper and some other, and some other herbs and seasonings that is fermented.
That's found at a lot of Korean groceries, and it's becoming increasingly popular mainstream. It's going mainstream.
Well, you know, there's also a lot of confusion about these fermented foods because those people who are on a yeast-free diet or an anti-candida diet say, but that's fermented, I can't have that. Well, this is the exception because even with candida, we need you to take some probiotics once we get rid of the candida overgrowth in the gut. So these are actually very beneficial foods.
Great. All right, so moving right along as we pass down the GI tract, we get to the large intestine, which is often the site of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. And we see an inordinate number of patients with those conditions because I wrote the introduction to a book called Breaking the Vicious Cycle by Elaine Gottschall a few years back. She was generous enough to have me write the introduction to the latest edition of her book, and she really revolutionized the approach, the dietary approach to inflammatory bowel disease by writing this book, must have been 3-4 decades ago when she first got out with that information. So tell us about the SCD, specific carbohydrate diet.
The specific carbohydrate diet is a wonderful therapeutic diet for those with intractable diarrhea, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, ulcerative proctitis. And it's generally the elimination of specific carbohydrates. All the grains are gone, potatoes are gone, any disaccharides, polysaccharides, meaning complex sugar molecules, that's your table sugar, that's your lactose, that's in milk, any fluid milk products are gone, any added sugars to foods are actually gone. The sugars that are allowed are fructose, and fructose is contained in all of our fruit and in honey.
But not high fructose corn syrup.
But not in high fructose corn syrup. That's actually a manufactured thing. So we're talking about naturally occurring fructose in our fruit and in our honey. It's actually a very helpful diet in that it contains all fresh and frozen meats. There are no processed meats. And when I say meats, I mean the whole category of meat. Meat, poultry, fish, eggs, all of those. All of the vegetables are allowed, except the very starchy ones like potatoes. Those would be out. All fruits are available as well. And there's homemade yogurt, which is a good source of probiotic. Or if that's not doable or attainable, there are certain brands of plain yogurt that are also that are also allowed on this particular eating plan. And because there are no grains at all on the specific carbohydrate diet, you can actually make baked goods with almond flour. Almond flour, walnut flour is actually another one. A lot of baked goods such as, you know, your own muffins, your own burger buns, your own breads, your own
biscotti. But these not made from grains, they're actually made from nut flour products, and they can be really quite delicious. I mean,
it is amazingly delicious. We had a patient a while back whose mother made, because the patient was actually allergic to almonds, he couldn't have any of the almond flour products, so his mother got walnut flour, and she baked muffins. She brought one in to me. It was divine.
Right, and
I had to stop and have a cup of tea with it. It was just divine.
And probably healthier for you than just, you know, good old-fashioned white bread.
Right.
Because, you know, the beneficial omega-3 fatty acids, healthy fibers,
The richness of the fat in nuts and the nut flour that translates to a brownie or something like that or a muffin is just amazing. You would never go back to regular flour.
Right. Also, you can have pancakes for breakfast. How are those pancakes made?
The pancake, yes, also with flour product, or there's also the addition of dry curd cottage cheese, which is farmer cheese.
Use the nut flour. Also, sometimes very ripe bananas can be used as part of that.
Yes.
Because actually you don't want the hard bananas because the starch in those bananas hasn't been broken down, but ripe bananas have the right kind of sugars that can be properly absorbed. So, look, I mean, I'm not going to say that it isn't something that is demanding. It really, you know, it requires a disciplined patient to follow the specific carbohydrate diet or the SCD. But patients achieve very, very dramatic results often with that. And, of course, sometimes we have to do some troubleshooting. There may be other issues that need to be addressed. You know, patients may have yeast problems. They may have parasites. They may have bacterial overgrowth.
Yeah.
They certainly require other anti-inflammatory nutrients when they have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. What are some of those that we'd like to provide patients?
We like to give them curcumin. We like boswellia. C-cure, definitely some enterocoated fish oil. These are part of the arsenal of reducing inflammation. And it's wonderful to see. We get so much success between that nutritional protocol and the SCD. It's remarkable. It's actually remarkable.
However, we do caution patients that, if they're coming, they really need to make substantial changes in their diet if they're going to. It's not just a matter of taking a handful of vitamins. Some patients say, well, I'm fine. I'll just shove a handful of vitamins in my mouth. The vitamins will cure me. That's your important role to seal the deal for dietary compliance with some of these conditions. And there's not one Hoffman Center diet. There's a myriad of diets that we use for various conditions. Another issue that I commented on in our most recent newsletter, by the way, for those of you who are not subscribing, you can email us radioprogram@AOL.com. One word, radioprogram@AOL.com gets you a subscription to the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. And my most recent rant, my most recent editorial in that newsletter has to do with GMOs. Now, we're just talking about gastrointestinal problems. You have any views on GMOs vis-a-vis GI problems?
Well, that study that you talked about in pigs, there was gastritis in the pigs that were fed GMO maize, GMO corn. So this is a reason to pause about the whole thing, really. If I may just comment, one more comment about the newsletter, Dr. Hoffman, so our subscribers know. Those who are recently subscribed but don't know how to get past issues, you just click on the link that says view it in your browser. And that gives you the opportunity to get all the past issues.
You can scroll through all the previous issues.
Exactly, So choose to view that newsletter in your browser, and then you will have the option to look at all the past.
Let's remind people about that pig study. I recently commented on GMOs, and I have to say that, I have been skeptical about GMOs for a long time, but I'm a scientific person, and if it could be demonstrated that there's absolutely no harm, even though these new genetically modified organisms are so weird, we've never seen this type of animal husbandry or agricultural breeding before. This is like a quantum leap into a new technology. I mean, in the past we would just mate animals and, sort of do it naturally. And yes, we can do very unusual things. You can just look at the dog breeds and, some of them are very unnatural. Very, very tiny dogs, very, very gigantic dogs, dogs with, all kinds of features like English bulldogs. These are not natural, but at least they're the product of mating animals in a natural way. When you combine genetic material in a test tube and you then create an artificial organism, in effect, you're really fooling with Mother Nature. And in the new study, what they did is they looked at 168 newly weaned piglets, and the study was done over 23 weeks. 84, that's half of the pigs, ate a diet that was made of genetically modified soy and corn, and the other group ate a normal non-GM diet, exactly the same soy and corn, but one was GM and one was non-GM. And what they found was quite disturbing. Those pigs that ate the GM diet had a higher rate of severe stomach inflammation. There's 32% of the GM-fed pigs compared to just 12% of the non-GM-fed pigs. And the inflammation was worse by a factor of 4 in the male pigs. And the only difference was genetically modified organisms versus non-genetically modified organisms. So this really should give us pause as we leap to embrace this new technology to save the world from starvation. And my goodness, we're seeing such an explosion in the rate of ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, very serious gastrointestinal ailments. And we wonder where it's from. I mean, are Americans eating too much junk, or is it we're giving people too many antibiotics? We're not having enough breastfeeding. I mean, there's a number of factors, but
all of the above. You just named them all.
Right. There's more to mention because we live in such an unnatural environment, chemicals and junk that we take in via our water and food. But it just gives us pause. Are GMO foods potentially harmful? So anyway, I wrote about that. Other things that can upset the gastrointestinal tract, there is this well-known MSG connection. You know, a lot of people think that MSG is just about, well, you know, I went to a Chinese restaurant and I got a headache. But there's more to MSG than just the headache phenomenon that's so familiar. You know, Chinese restaurant syndrome where you break into a sweat and you feel a tight band around your head. What about MSG and its effects on the gut?
MSG can have terrible effects on the gut. A lot of gastrointestinal complaints, discomfort, issues, all of that. And, you know, scientific researchers who use laboratory rats, they fatten up their rats with MSG. That's how they get them fat. You've heard about Chinese food.
Yeah.
You know, why are you hungry after an hour again? That's the MSG. It enhances, it hastens gastric emptying. So you're hungry sooner rather than later. So there's MSG, there's that whole glutamate connection also in the brain, and the gut and the brain is linked. So, and the problem is also that MSG doesn't have to be called MSG or monosodium glutamate on an ingredient label. It could simply say natural flavors. We don't know what that is.
Yeast
that
extract.
Could be,
there's a
yeast
lot of
extract. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're stuck. The FDA has allowed that to happen, unfortunately, instead of just calling it what it is. So it's ubiquitous, really. It's all over the place. It's not just about Chinese food. It's in a can of soup. It's in any restaurant, especially a chain restaurant, where we may frequently eat. So it's there.
So what's the answer for people just seeking the most healthy diet? I mean, I know there are specific diets that are therapeutic for certain conditions, but what do you consider the ideal diet? I mean, where should people be striving these days?
Natural whole foods, the way they're found in nature. Shopping around the perimeter of the grocery store, meaning all of your fresh and frozen produce, all of your fresh and frozen meats, and unless you're buying soap or laundry detergent that day, then you could go up and down the aisles, but not for the snack foods. Whole foods, the way they're found in nature. That's really the way we're meant to eat. Our proteins, our vegetables, our fruits, in that order, really, nuts and seeds. That's essentially it.
And packaged and processed foods with unmentionable chemical names on the label, these are to be avoided.
Yes, yes. An occasional dark chocolate is good.
We need a reward. I mean, look, one thing that I know about you is that, you know, you're not a food Nazi. You know, you really want your patients to enjoy and indulge because, I mean, if you clamp down on people too severely, they're just going to rebel. And that's, you know, they're going to be, you know, it's like the little girl who was, when she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was very, very bad. We don't want people to be skitsy about food, like, you know.
And I always tell this one, I say, you know, nobody was interested in the cookie jar that was sitting on the kitchen counter for the past 20 years until somebody took it away.
Uh-huh.
Then suddenly we're obsessed.
Right.
Where are the cookies? You didn't want them that much before, but now we're obsessed. Yes, we can't be food Nazis, you know.
Yeah, people used to have a cookie jar. That is before they got giant-sized, 48-ounce packages of Oreos that were easily bought at Walmart.
Yeah. Yeah, another reason not to go to Walmart.
Usually those cookies were homemade. So one other thing that, you know, I know there's a lot to bite off literally in today's interview, but I wanted to comment on a phenomenon that has really hit the big time lately, which is the paleo diet. The paleo diet, you know, so often touted as virtually a panacea for many conditions. First of all, what is it and what's your take on it?
The paleo diet or the paleolithic diet is based simply on a diet of whole foods. Of whole foods, we got to think about what did our Stone Age ancestors eat. They ate the animals they killed. They ate leaves and plants. They had roots and shoots. They had berries and fruit when it was available. They had maybe some nuts and seeds. There was no cereal. There was no oatmeal. There was no bagel, not even some rice. There certainly wasn't any milk. Or cheese.
We're talking pre-civilization, pre-pyramids, ancient Greece or Rome, pre-agriculture, in fact. You know,
pre-agriculture, absolutely. Right. Absolutely, because in Greece and Rome there was honey and there was heart disease because of other sugars they were having and so forth and so on. So
diabetes, yeah.
Diabetes, yes. So pre-agriculture, that's really Paleolithic. It may be the ultimate anti-inflammatory diet for most people. It's certainly a wonderful autoimmune diet for those suffering with autoimmune diseases or conditions.
Because great for our patients with multiple sclerosis, for example.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and actually, it's theorized that these newer foods to civilization, our grains and our dairy products, are actually triggering the immune system in adverse ways and triggering autoimmunity. So, and we see a lot of turnaround with our patients who go paleo.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's plenty of resources for that, and if you want some more custom nutrition, you know where to go. Layla Mudin is the nutritionist at the Hoffman Center, and we appreciate very much your contribution today. Unfortunately, we're running short on time, but we'll invite you back for some more sessions, talk about various issues related to nutrition.
Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, and it was a great kickoff to our new series of interviews that we're going to be posting on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us, and make sure you join us for our next edition of Intelligent Medicine.